Hello and welcome. We're going to discuss limited liability companies and the wonderful world of public authorities tonight. It's a very interesting class, and we hope that you are all safe and well and doing beautifully tonight. And I want to introduce you to something that's very exciting. The new world of LLCs, limited liability companies, that's going to take up most of our lecture tonight because it's really the modern way to start a company. And remember, as we discussed previously, an LLC is kind of like a corporation and a partnership had a baby. They are combined together, and it takes the benefits of a corporation, that limited liability concept, and marries it with a partnership. And it's the ease and nimbleness of a smaller business organization together with some of the power that we've seen corporations. Now, last time, we wrapped up our four-part series on corporations. Corporations are an amazing vehicle for business organizations. They are a magnet for capital. They allow, through their limited liability and their artificial person status under the law, to be able to do some incredible things. They can have a perpetual existence, as we discussed before. Isn't that important? Because they can never die. They can go on forever. The Guinness Corporation in Ireland that manufactures Guinness beer has been going on for hundreds of years. Isn't that exciting? We have corporations in the United States that are also very senior. One of them is right here in the state of New York. Remington Firearms, which is in Ilion, New York, that manufactures firearms for not only the Army, but for all sorts of individuals as well as businesses, police officers, things of that nature. Remington Firearms was started around 1802. It's an old company, and it's a perpetual existence. It's been making things in Ilion, New York, all the way for over 220 years. Pretty amazing. Okay. Last time we wrapped up our four-part series on corporations with corporate governance. How are corporations run? How are they controlled? Now, being an artificial person under the law, recognized as an individual person, not a natural person, but a person with many rights and privileges, when we recognize that, how does it operate? Well, it can only operate through other people because the first word of that is artificial. It's not a natural person. It doesn't have legs, can't walk around, but what it can do is act as a person acts. And it does that by means of its agents, employees, officers, and directors. Shareholders drive the bus. Why? Because they elect the people who are the board of directors. And the board of directors is the governing body of the corporation. They set the policy. They set the big ticket items. They make the major decisions. Is this corporation going to manufacture automobiles or light bulbs? Are they going to be a service corporation, or are they going to be a corporation that does manufacturing? What kind of business is it going to be? That is up to the board of directors. How big is it going to be? Is it going to have separate divisions? Is it going to focus on one simple product or service? Or is it going to do many things and try and do it more broadly? Those are all questions for boards of directors. Now, remember our friend Ira Milstein, who is the corporate governance guru, says that the ultimate size of a board of directors is 7 people. Because that way it's big enough to get the diverse interests that you can have, enough different opinions that help be able to run the corporation with a breadth of knowledge, but it's small enough and nimble enough that it doesn't get bogged down in bureaucracy. I think Ira in a perfect world is correct. The problem is the world isn't always perfect. And bigger corporations that try and do more things and have broad interests frequently need more than 7 people on their board of directors. Particularly now when you have what we talked about 2 weeks ago with corporate regulation on the forefront, whereby a lot of these corporations are required to devolve into separate committees so that their boards of directors form individual committees to do individual things. Those corporation board of directors committees have to have different people on them. And if you only have 7 people, everybody's going to be on every committee, and that doesn't help. What you need is people with expertise in the different committees that you're going to do. You have an audit committee, you'll have a finance committee, you'll have different committees for the different types of operations that you wish to do. If you're a car company, you'll have a committee for tires, a committee for headlights, all these different committees for the different divisions you might produce. So it depends on your company. Now, for the average one, a smaller corporation, Ira's right. 7 is a perfect number. Because again, it's broad enough to get a diversity of opinion, but small enough to be nimble and be able to operate and make decisions and make them quickly. But when you grow big, your idea takes off, and your corporation gets bigger, you should probably have a bigger board of directors. And the board of directors is where it begins and ends. They're elected by the shareholders in a Republican form of government. That means they're representatives. Shareholders, stockholders, do not run the corporation. They elect people who do. And the people who do the work, who decide the decisions, are the board of directors. They want to be friendly with the shareholders. Why? Just like anybody else in a Republican form of government, like your Congress people, they want to be friendly with the voters because they want the voters to vote for them. And in a board of directors, they want to be friendly with the shareholders because the shareholders vote for them. That's why they'll do things like declare a dividend, give money back to the shareholders. It's why they try and make the corporation grow and be successful. Because a shareholder with a valuable stock who can sell it at a profit is a happy shareholder. So boards of directors relate back to the shareholders. And the shareholders will throw out a board of director member that isn't doing what they need to be successful. Just like our government. Now, one of the biggest things that boards of directors do is they hire the officers. Whereas the board of directors is the policy-making entity, they think about big things, the officers do the day-to-day work of the corporation. They're the ones who really run it. And they're headed up by the chief executive officer. That's the number one point person of the corporation. Yes, the chairman of the board of directors is a very important person. But the chief executive officer does the day-to-day work of the corporation. That's the person who generally signs the contracts, the person who hires employees, the person who decides how to execute the missions given to him or her by the board of directors. Then you'll have the president of the corporation. Now, where you don't have a chief executive officer, the president does the work of the chief executive officer. But where you have a CEO, a chief executive officer, the president basically does whatever the CEO tells them. They're more of a ceremonial title. Then you'll have the vice presidents. Unlike a vice president in a political form of government, vice presidents in a corporation structure generally are a mini CEO for a division. They turn around and will run things on a smaller scale through delegation by not only the boards of directors or by the CEO. So if you're making light bulbs, if you're making tires, if you're doing something that is different in each one of your divisions of your corporation, the vice president is the head of that. They oversee that. They try to make their mission of their division the absolute best in the company. And when there's a problem, it's their neck that's on the chopping block. And as a result of that, most CEOs do not come from the president rank. They come from the vice president. Why? Because they've proven that they can run a division, a part of the company, and do it successfully. So most CEOs actually come out of those division vice presidencies. Then you will have the chief financial officer. The chief financial officer is the person who cares for the financial health of the corporation. They're the people who handle all the money. They hire the accountants. They turn around and make sure that the books are proper for the financial health of the corporation. They do an awful lot of work wherever it comes, the money touches the corporation. And remember, the whole purpose of a corporation is to operate a business for what? Profit, to make money. So chief financial officers are very powerful, very important person. And just like the CEO, they have to sign the reports that go to the SEC or go to other regulators such as the state attorney general. They're the ones who have to sign things and say, yes, this financial statement is true. This is how much money the corporation took in. This is how much money it spent. The chief financial officer is the person who has his reputation on the line when it comes to the financial matters. The CEO is the person who has his reputation on the line for everything, not just the finances. They have to sign those reports. And if they sign a report that's not true, they can go to jail. They can be sued. So they have to make sure they know what's going on, and they have to make sure that those reports are truthful. Lastly, you have a treasurer, generally just like the president, or you have a chief financial officer. The treasurer does whatever the CFO, chief financial officer, tells them to do. Where you don't have a CFO, the treasurer does the job of the CFO. And they sign the reports for the CFO where they're required under regulation or statute. And very lastly, you have perhaps the most important person who's an officer in a corporation, and that's the secretary. The secretary is the person who communicates for the corporation. They're the ones who talk to all the shareholders, albeit orally or in writing. They're the one who registers all the shareholders. Because remember, you can't be a shareholder until you're registered with the corporation. Why? They need to know who gets to vote. And at the time of the annual meeting, who notifies you? The secretary. Who counts the votes? Who receives the proxies? The secretary. The secretary is a very powerful person within the corporation. They are the voice of the corporation. They are the person who turns around and has to communicate with the shareholders, who are, again, the sovereigns of the corporation because they're the ultimate power due to the fact that they can vote to elect the boards of directors. Lastly, The officers hire employees and agents. So if you're running a supermarket, the person who pushes the supermarket cart, the cashier, the stock clerk, all of those people are hired by the officers. Now, can the officer appoint someone to do some of the hiring? Sure can. They can appoint the head of human resources, for example. But all of those people get appointed directly through or indirectly from the officers. Officers are very powerful. The employees make it go, but who's responsible? The officers. And who are the officers responsible to? The board of directors. And who's the board of directors accountable to? The shareholders. That's the way it looks. That's the way it works. Lastly, two things we discussed wrapping up last week was corporate liability. Frequently, because of the business judgment rule, which says as long as your officers, directors, and shareholders too are following their roles, are doing what they're supposed to do, are maintaining their duties to the corporation, and they all have fiduciary duties, as long as they're doing that, they cannot be collected against for a problem. So if a corporation loses money and the shareholders get mad at them and they bring what is called a shareholder derivative action to say, boards of directors, you made stupid decisions. As long as those board of directors can demonstrate that they did such trying to make a profit for the company, that they used their best business judgment and the markets just didn't respond as they thought it would be. No one is required to have a crystal ball. The business judgment rule protects those boards of directors and those officers under that ground. Corporate liability only comes into play. Remember this when there's fraud. If a board of director violated their fiduciary duty, they were double dealing, they were trading against the corporation, or they were trying to make money for themselves instead of for the company. They were doing something naughty. If there's fraud, then there's going to be liability. If there's not, if they were doing the best they can and they just lost money, no liability. And the limited liability nature of the corporation that says that those shareholders who are the ultimate investors, they're the people who put the money up. They don't have liability either. Why? Because of the fact that that's the nature of a corporation. It has limited liabilities baked into the bread. As long as there's no fraud, that the shareholders didn't turn around and do that. Where a shareholder, for instance, is using the corporation for their own personal benefit, driving the company car, flying the company plane, and that has happened, then that shareholder might be on the hook for things. But that's fraud. Where there's no fraud, there's no liability. They only have the liability of their original investment. So if they invested and bought stock for $100 and the corporation loses millions, don't look to that shareholder. Don't look to that officer. Don't look to that director. It's called bankruptcy, and it's good done. Okay, lastly, last thing that we wrapped up last week, termination. Corporation is a person under the law. They're an artificial person. Because of that, they can have a perpetual existence. They can go on forever. But there are some times when the corporation wants to or needs to end. It's losing money. It's not fulfilling its purpose of trying to make a profit. It is no longer having utility. It makes buggy whips and now we have cars. It is doing something that's no longer needed in society. that corporation can dissolve. And it can dissolve in one of two ways. If it's a perpetual existence, it terminates its corporate existence by a vote of the board of directors first, and frequently required also pursuant to either the bylaws or the corporate charter, by the shareholders themselves. Or it can have a forced dissolution, either through bankruptcy or through lawsuit. Now, a corporation that has a limited lifetime in its corporate charter, it says it's only going to last for X years, that can end too. And when that termination occurs, when that vote happens, or when that time happens, guess what? All the assets of the corporations get marshaled into a pot. They get collected. It's not like partnership property where the partner can take it home as part of the dissolution. It is marshaled into one big pile. Because that property of a corporation is not property of the shareholders. It's not property of the officers or of the directors or of the employees. It's property of the corporation. And if that corporation is being terminated, if it's dying, all those assets have to be marshaled. You're running the supermarket, have to sell off the shopping carts, have to sell off the display cases, have to sell off all the inventory. All of that gets sold. And a big pile of money gets collected. All the liabilities have to be paid off. Every one of them. And what happens when you have that? You have a certain amount of money left over. Hopefully you have more money left over than the liabilities you have. If you don't, then you're bankrupt, and we'll discuss that in a future election. But if you're solvent, that means you have more money coming in than going out, then that big pile of money gets collected, and then it gets distributed out to the shareholders based upon their share. If you have 1/1000th of the corporation in the shares that you own, you get 1/1000th of that pile of money. That's how it gets dissolved. That's how it gets spread out. No individual gets it within the corporate structure, just the shareholders. Why? They gave the original investment and they get what's returned. Okay, that's last week's lecture. Let's go on to this week. We have two things to talk about this week, and it's exciting stuff. Public benefit corporations and limited liability companies. LLCs are a special animal, but they're not that old. When we talked about corporations, they went all the way back to ancient Rome. Sole proprietorships and partnerships did too. So they've been around for thousands of years. Limited liability companies, only been around since 1994 in New York State. Relatively new entity. Matter of fact, one of the first things that I did in my legal career as a counsel in the state legislature, I worked on the limited liability company law. I helped write that statute. It was very exciting at the time because this new business organization entity was coming onto the forefront to help particularly small business get started, get protected, and help them grow to become a great business. LLCs are exciting. We'll talk about them. But first, let's talk about a public benefit corporation. Whereas a business corporation, which we just spent four units on, is to operate a business for profit, a public benefit corporation is just what it sounds like. It's a corporation formed to do something for the benefit of the public. It's not a not-for-profit corporation. A not-for-profit corporation is a private corporation that an individual or group of individuals can form to do something which is not only a public benefit, but frequently a charitable operation, that they'll turn around and try and do scientific work, or they'll turn around and try and do charitable work, or they'll turn around and try and do educational work, and their intent is not to make a profit, it's to do some kind of public service. But a public benefit corporation is a specific type of animal under the law. It's a corporation with all the powers of a corporation, but it's chartered by the state of New York or the federal government. Remember when corporations first came on the scene in the United States, they were all chartered by the state legislatures or the federal government. All of them. And it wasn't until the 1840s that stopped, that we allowed through our general incorporation laws to have individuals go in and file the records with the Department of State and have that corporate charter written up and bring in the Articles of Incorporation, have the Secretary of State's office look at it and say, okay, that's all good, you met all the requirements of the statute, you get a business corporation. That's not the way a public benefit corporation works. Under the state constitution, public benefit corporations must be chartered by the state of New York. The federal government can do it too. When they're chartered by the state legislature, these public benefit corporations act on behalf of the government to do governmental purposes. One of the most famous ones that people recognize because they use it so much is the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. These corporations are frequently called state authorities, and the MTA is no different. The reason why they're called authorities we'll get to in a minute, but the MTA is a very famous public benefit corporation because it runs all the railroads and buses and transportation networks in New York City. The Thruway Authority is another famous one. It built the thruway. It runs the thruway. Starting to see a picture here? What a public benefit corporation does is finance, operate, and maintain a state interest. So with the thruway, for example, Governor Dewey, who was the governor of the state of New York, and before him an assemblyman by the name of Abbott Lowe Moffat, wanted to build a state highway from New York City to Albany and Albany to Buffalo. Never been done before. They looked at the autobahns, this is after World War II, that all the soldiers who were returning home from World War II saw in Germany. These were high-speed highways that ran with multiple lanes from one section of the country to the other. And Thomas Dewey, who was the governor, wanted one in New York. We're a big state. So he built over 600 miles of high-speed highway from New York City all the way to Buffalo. But to do that, that came at a cost. It was expensive. Nobody'd ever done it before. And he turned around and he formed a public authority from the Thruway Authority. They issued bonds, and those bonds are paid back by means of the tolls that are paid on the Thruway. And those tolls are also, by the way, the bonds were paid off a long time ago. The original bonds were paid off in the 1980s because it was built in the 1950s and they were 30-year bonds. But why do we still have the tolls? Because you need to maintain the road. The road has to be resurfaced, it has to be plowed, it has to be redesigned. Spurs are built off the road. New exits are built sometimes. And as a result of that, you need a flow of income. Well, that's what public authorities do. They finance, they build, they operate, and they maintain. On behalf of the public, that's why they're called public benefit corporations. Now, the first one of these things was done in England. was done in London because London, which is a seafaring country, the capital of a seafaring country of England, London had its port in disrepair. It was hundreds of years old. Modern ships were not able to come into the port the way they wanted it to. So they had to turn around and basically renovate its port to keep its seafaring predominant status. So they created this public benefit corporation, a new idea. And throughout the course of the bill that Parliament passed to create this, to charter this new public benefit corporation, the Port of London bill, they said that this new corporation shall have the authority to finance. It shall have the authority to issue bonds. It shall have the authority to operate the port after the bonds are issued. It shall have the authority to do construction projects and to hire people to do the construction projects. It shall have the authority to turn around and collect dock fees so that it was able to pay off the bonds. And because throughout the course of the bill, it constantly was saying, it shall have the authority to, it got nicknamed the Port of London Authority. And ever since then, these things have not just been called public benefit corporations, they've been called public authorities. Well, the first one in the United States was actually in New York. New York does like to copy people sometimes. And in 1921, its port, which at the time was the largest port in the United States, that is no longer the case. The largest port today is in California, Long Beach. But New York has still got a great port. And in 1921, we renovated our port. And we did it the same way London did. We created a public authority. Now, half of New York's port is in New Jersey. So we created a joint authority. We didn't do it with the state. We did it with the federal government. Congress chartered that public authority in 1921 to redo the New York port. But it did it as a bi-state authority. It said half of that port is in New Jersey, half of it is in New York, so we'll do a joint authority, we'll call it the Port Authority. And still today, since 1921, it's been operating the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, both, operates together with both those states sending commissioners to run it, operates and builds and maintains the New York port. It's done a great job. And after that was so successful, a series of governors recognized, starting with none other than Franklin Roosevelt, that we could use these public benefit corporations, these public authorities, to do great things. In 1928, when he first runs for governor, Franklin Roosevelt runs on one major issue. I want to electrify all of upstate New York. New York City had a lot of electricity. It had a lot of people, so there was a lot of market there for people who were putting in electrical wires to homes to be able to do that. Not so in upstate, much more rural place, particularly back in the 1920s. But Roosevelt said every part of New York ought to be able to have electricity. And it wasn't really economically feasible for private enterprise to do that because they couldn't get a return on their dollar fast enough. Because remember, those corporations need to make a profit. Well, Roosevelt said, we're going to create a public authority and we're going to deliver electricity to all of upstate New York through a new organization called the Power Authority. Before that, you had these little electrical stations. They only go a little way to deliver power. people had generators in their house or they went without power. After the power authority delivered power across upstate New York, primarily by building power plants along the waterways in upstate New York. And it helped to turn that over to private business after they built those things to something called the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation. It was a private industry. But it was charged and started by the Power Authority, this public benefit corporation, who put in all that infrastructure that then private enterprise could turn around and operate and maintain and then build upon. Now today, Niagara Mohawk is called National Grid. But there's a reason why they were called the Niagara Mohawk Corporation. Niagara River, Niagara Falls, Nikola Tesla built most of the turbines for Niagara Falls, were used to generate electricity. And the Mohawk River, throughout the course of it, was used to generate electricity. And by that mechanism, it was helped to electrify most of upstate New York. But it couldn't have done it without the capital infusion by the Power Authority, which built these entities, sold the bonds, and then collected it back through ratepayers. Today, you have hundreds of public authorities to do everything from building parking garages to doing major things like building stadiums and building housing, building transportation networks, airports, all of those kinds of major infrastructure projects. You turn around, a lot of them are done by public benefit corporations. They're an amazing entity. And we have a whole system of law known as the public authorities law. And it provides how these corporations are structured. It governs how the bonds are sold. Remember this guy, Abbott Lowe Moffitt. He's the guy that did the throughway with Governor Dewey. The public authorities are amazing entities. And they're in the state constitution, once again, because of Mr. Moffitt. He was the one who wrote our constitutional provisions in 1939, when our most recent constitution came into being. He was a delegate, a statewide elected delegate, for the constitutional convention, and he wrote all the provisions on public authorities. And he stood up and said, these entities ought to be independent. They ought to be able to stand on their own two feet. They shouldn't be supported by government. They should be supported by their bondholders. And they should only do the financing and the construction within the purview that the public authorities law, that statute that creates each public authority, allows it to do.